You're listening to Wake Up Tucson. This podcast is a Bustos Media production on The Voice. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
So, Juneteenth, this is a piece from Ryan Bamberger from townhall.com. And this was from last year after it was made a federal holiday. Juneteenth, a profound holiday that's relatively known by a relatively few until now. I've written about it for years. It has a special meaning. It signified the nearly three-year delayed emancipation of 250,000 slaves in Texas who hadn't received the news even a month after the end of the Civil War. It exemplified the hard-fought sacrifice of black and white brothers and sisters working together to end the evil of chattel slavery. Now, bipartisan legislation passed overwhelmingly in both the House and the Senate. This is from last year, remember. And then President laying underneath his bicycle signed it into law. And of course, one of the things he didn't do was take the opportunity to praise the great state of Texas for taking it a lead and making it a holiday four decades ago. Imagine telling that to your leftist friends, that the first state to really jump in and make it a state holiday was Texas. Well, it can't be. They're like gun pro-life fools. Can't do that, right? The bill was offered by Democrat legislator Al Edwards, signed into law by Republican Governor William Perry Clements Jr. in 1980. So what Mr. Bamberger says, I wish that alternative names for Juneteenth would become official. Because Juneteenth means nothing. Oh, we took the word June and 19th and put it together. Great. I like what this guy says. He keeps the Juneteenth, but he adds the name. Why not just call it Emancipation Day? I guess it's official. So that would get confused. So Juneteenth, just call June 19th Emancipation Day or Freedom Day. Those names evoke a truer essence of the historical moment. He says, I can see how this will be exploited by those whose propensity to divide us by color, class, or other characteristics seem to know no end. Juneteenth doesn't belong to any one group of people. It belongs to all Americans. It's a testament to the unity of both black and whites who went to great length to break the chains of bondage. It can be a great reminder to the American public and the world that we went to, that the Democrat, well, see, let's get to this, okay? I was just talking to a couple of friends this weekend who are, would be considered kind of older conservative Republicans. And I said, Monday is Juneteenth. They're like, oh, that stupid thing? I mean, that's stupid. Why are we letting the Democrats take this over? This is our holiday. It's all of America's holiday. But that's this guy, Mr. Bamberger, says, it's a great reminder that to the American Republic and the world how the Democrat Party went to war to protect the evil of slavery, but a radical Republican named Abraham Lincoln altered the trajectory of a nation. No amount of 1619 revisionism can change that. Juneteenth commemorates the collective realization that our national creed about being created equal was becoming slow but assured reality. That equality, because it's not given to us by a man or woman or governmental institution, should start the moment we're created, the moment of conception. Sadly, half the country doesn't believe this today and supports another group of human beings being dehumanized and discriminated against for who they are. What he says is, every person's a human, every human's a person. Juneteenth's about the emancipation of an entire nation, of freeing those previously shackled and preventing former shacklers from treating fellow humans like property. It's a reminder of the biblical principle that once that we're created from one blood, implemented in the natural. Yes, we're a beautifully colorful human race. Major General Gordon Granger and 2,000 Union soldiers, many of those saw much loss and devastation during the Civil War, delivered the delayed news that hundreds of thousands of slaves were no longer bound. Speaking the truth about emancipation was an extremely difficult journey for all those involved in that sacred effort. There was no system of mass communication in 1865. Major General Granger traveled from place to place in Galveston, Texas, in order to read General Order Number 3, which proclaimed, quote, all slaves are free, unquote. He and the soldiers under this command had to bring the truth to the people. It's tragic how many times as humans we remain in chains that have already been broken. So, anyway, I like Freedom Day is probably pretty good. And then it's so perfect, right? It's 2 weeks before 4th of July, right? Independence Day, which we keep saying, keep leaning towards saying the word Independence Day. Just like Juneteenth is Freedom Day, 4th of July is Independence Day. And they should be tied together. We should be doing a whole month of this stuff instead of just shaming people in June that don't dig transgender drag queens. So, wake up, Tucson. And now we're in the middle of the great Joanne DiFilippo breaking down your Pima County agenda, past, present, and future, as we like to say. Joanne, welcome back, young lady.
Thanks, Chris.
And let's get to, you did some great digging here. You looked at how much money, they want they put $700,000 change that they would like to do this study. It could be done for less, right? Something like this, you think?
Yeah. And you know what, in all honesty, and I do want to say the supervisors, and I believe it was Grijalva who actually asked the question, how did you derive this figure?
Yeah.
But it wasn't the proper format for getting into the detail like that. But what happened is, and again, you know, these are small business guys, and they may or may not be used to addressing items as expected on government proposals, let's say. So they came up with an overall figure. What should have happened is they should have given a breakdown of how that figure was derived. How did they come up with the $700,000? Was, you know, $100,000 necessary for data collection, et cetera? So it should have been broken down. However, I do believe that the study could be done for less funding. It just, you know, you have to take a look at how they derive that figure. And they need to be given the opportunity to explain that.
Now,
but nevertheless.
So one thing I want to ask you a question is, the Adelitas and Rex Scotts of the world who don't want an independent study. They say we can just...
That was very apparent.
Right. We have all the stuff here. Why would we do that? Talk about why it's important for an independent audit to get done.
Well, one of the reasons why you want an independent audit is because you would like to have a study that is free of bias. You know, when you've got the county pulling the data and reporting on the county's performance, you always run the risk of tainted data. Remember, you know, when you're looking at garbage in is garbage out is when you're looking at.
Amen, sister.
You know, and if you think that somebody's going to turn out a true report that has a negative reflection of performance, you're kidding yourself.
Remember, this is the same county that said if you didn't pass don't pass the roads, don't just fix the roads proposition, there would be no money ever to fix a road.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's a whole other issue.
Correct.
And so you know, I mean, that's why, for example, in federal grants, almost every federal grant that I write, and I've written millions and millions of dollars of grants that have been funded, you use external evaluators. And the purpose of that is you're demonstrating to the federal government that your program's performance is going to be evaluated in as much of a bias-free environment as possible so that the data collected is true and accurate. The analysis can be true and accurate. You know, again, it's like having the fox in the chicken coop, which the county has a propensity to do. It repeats it over and over, which makes you believe, why is there a reason why they don't want outsiders coming in to take a look at their data?
So, Joe, start going through what they've already blown money on in relation to this money from CARES Act and things like that.
So I want the viewers or listeners to be aware that this is all public information, and you can research it yourself if you go to PEMArecovers.com. Remember, this is the web portal within the county's website where they're accounting for. This is part of their quote-unquote Transparency Act, okay, where they're letting all the taxpayers know where all the CARES COVID funding is being spent. So what I did is I just went to one segment also, and it's called the Economic Recovery. And here's what we've got. $409,791 to the Small Business Support Downtown Tucson Partnership. That's from CARES funding.
All right, $409,000 to the Downtown Partnership. Okay.
$409,791. Okay. $455,000. To the Small Business Support 4th Avenue Merchants Association.
Okay.
$917,665 to the Pima County Small Business and Child Care Center grant.
Hold on. Pima County Small Business Child Care Center grants.
Small Business and Child Care Center grants.
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah.
Okay.
And remember, that's all separate from PEEPS and all that, okay?
Yep.
$4 million to the Old Tucson Reopening Assistance.
$4 million bucks?
Yeah, because we have to prepare Old Tucson to get ready for the new lessees.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. $4.7 million to Keno Stadium. Now, that's for various projects. Remember, like, you know, the pavement, et cetera. I just added them all up.
Again,
popcorn poppers.
Remember, this is supposed to be coronavirus recovering, right. Not yeah. capital projects no. crap.
Popcorn yeah. maker
and,
tune-up.
And remember this. Everything that we're talking about has some type of a maintenance and or continued support funding after CARES money goes away.
Right.
So that's what you have to keep looking at, okay?
Okay.
$363,094 for back to business marketing. Now that's interesting because I would think that that would have been part of Visit Tucson. Okay.
Well, no, this is the thing where basically they were putting stickers on a door that said it's safe to come in and you won't die. So that seems like $363,000 of stickers, and that might have been the wall of shame for the business owners that they were narking on.
Well, the taxpayers, $363,094 went to that. $500,000 to the City of Gastronomy Food Destination Promotion.
Okay, so that is a Visit Tucson function in the end, right? That they put into the City of Gastronomy's. I'd like to know what. I mean, I love the idea of the City of Gastronomy, but I'd love to see a report on how they're spending the money, because what I usually see is Felipe Garcia and two chefs fly to some really cool place in Italy where no one's coming from Italy to Tucson and saying, look what we do.
And the reason why, remember how I talked to you about independent evaluation?
Yeah.
There is none. There is none. You know, I'll tell you, one of the things you want to be aware of is when you go in and you pull up each one of these items, it's related to a contract. Now, you can go into the Clerk of the Board's website and you can put that name in, and it'll pull up the contract that was allocated for this funding. You can go in and take a look at the scope of work within each one of these contracts. So if you want to see what the City of Gastronomy was supposed to do with that $500,000, you do that. You go in and you pull up the contract. The thing that you do then is you do a public records request asking for, you want a copy of the performance report. It's that simple.
Gotcha.
And it'll be interesting to see what you get. And we will be doing follow-up on that, okay?
All right, now tell me.
That's how you see how the... Now, let's go back to the list.
Yep.
So, now next we've got $655,000 for Economic Recovery Communications and Outreach. Okay. Then we've got $150,000 for Economic Recovery Marketing.
So, $655,000 for Communications, but $150,000 for Recovery Marketing. Which I assume had to go to somebody who's a buddy, but we'll look at it.
What's interesting then is when you take a look at that, Then you'd have to go in and see who was that $655,000 allocated towards. Was it towards Pima County Communications Department? Was it towards a subrecipient under a subaward agreement? Because that's basically a category. That's not a company. Do you follow me?
Yeah.
So
agreed.
You'd have to go in and take a look at that. So, and then our last one.
This one gets me excited.
$3.2 million for leased properties reopening assistance. Now,
I assume this is for Pima Airspace, Desert Museum, these places.
Yes. This is for all Pima County's own properties that they then lease. So Matt, remember.
So Matt had a good thought here. Hey, now how about Worldview and the Bank of America building and all this other jazz? Was that included in that, or just the tourism lease properties? Do you know?
You'd have to go into like facilities for Pima Recovers.
Gotcha.
That we can do. Yeah. So you have to think, where did they place this money in what category? And I encourage listeners, go to PimaRecovers.com. You will fall over when you see the categories and how much money is allocated. And then what I really want you to take a look at is how much money is allocated for coronavirus and health issues. That's what would really blow your mind.
That's a whole other show right there. So what I did was while you were doing this, I took out my my adding machine. Matt, was you heard in the background, and I added all of that up, right? So they can't figure out a few hundred thousand dollars to figure out how their decisions. So whatever happens again, we don't do things, right? $300,000 to $400,000. You just rattled off $15,350,550, according to my math.
And then add in the $5.95 million for Visit Tucson, and you are at
$21 million.
Yeah.
Jeez.
And we cannot give the Small Business Commission funding to do an independent study, which would tremendously benefit the small business community, which is the backbone of this community's existence.
Again, you're right. And again, because the idea is that they know there's a great possibility that it's going to throw some shade on their decisions. And that's the most important thing, is that never happens.
And that's why
Adelita Grijalva threatened volunteers on a commission.
I mean, it was very sad to see, to tell you the truth. And then when I went in and did the research and found that she is the one supervisor who never bothered to take time out of her schedule to go and meet. I will give the other supervisors credit, and I will specifically give credit to Supervisor Christie, who is helping this commission to try and achieve what is only in their bylaws, what is within the scope of why this commission was established.
So we had all five candidates. We did this modified debate format where we did a randomized pairings of each of them. And then we asked questions that were, I didn't write any of the questions. They all came from the members of the Northwest Republican Association. And we had opening, closing, and then at the end, we did I had their names on an index card. I told them to pick a card, and they got to, whoever's name is on there, they got to ask that person a question. So overall, in the end, I would say the person who didn't do the best was Kathleen Wynne. You could tell that once she got outside of her certain level of comfort, there was discomfort. Then Young Mayberry, I thought, did very well. And again, what I like Young. I like his story. I like how he talks about government, you know, but does he get you excited about what's going on, right? That was always going to be a challenge for Young. Lucretia Free she's an intelligent lady, and I've known Lucretia for the last few years. We used to be on the Pima County Transportation Advisory Committee, and I don't know if she's going to pull this one out, but she's a good candidate, and she hopefully she runs for something else if this doesn't work out. And then you had, I thought, you know, Juan did very well, and then Brandon was doing very well towards the end, till the end, right? And what happened was, and I've noticed this year with Brandon, he's a lot more abrasive about stuff. He's done with the bullcrap of campaigning, it feels like. And so at certain situations, he just goes. And so he got Young Mayberry as his person he had to ask a question. So instead of asking a nice question of that person, he said, why don't you ask Juan Siscomani why he worked blah, blah, blah. That kind of thing. And then at that moment, I think Brandon, who I thought was doing very well, lost several or more people in the room. He just looked kind of that. He kind of looked like that angry guy. And I get it, right? Because he's, you know, he's running for the third time. Juan's got a lot of juice to his campaign. Juan's got $1 million, and Brandon's got $37,000. So, you know, it gets to that point as you get closer and closer to primary day, you'll have more of these situations. So, again, for a lot of people, I thought Brandon was doing really good until right at the end there, where he kind of showed a little bit of the abrasive side. And I don't know. I guess that got his crew maybe fired up, but I don't think it got the majority of the room fired up. So, anyway, I thought it was a great event. A couple of people came up to see us and say, and this is what's good about this Northwest Republican Association, right, is it's great to see a functional group of Republicans, right? We're not yelling at each other. We're not, you know, doing the, you know, the stuff like the, you know, the rage coming from the Wadsack Jones, yeah, it's sad to say, Antonori's of the world. And it was just nice to have 220 Republicans, plus whoever else was there in relation to, you know, some of the people that were working it and stuff, just having a good time and actually having people strive with good ideas. So, again, I have a friend of mine, Connie, who's like, she was upset that the former LD11 decided to become this Northwest Republican Association and not, and just, they should just fold up everything and go join LD17. And I said, why don't we wait? Let's wait for 3 to 4 months and let's see what happens. Let's watch the, you know, what goes on at the Northwest Republican Association and what goes on at LD17. Well, the last two times LD17 met on a Saturday, and they couldn't figure out it. They actually had to cancel one of their first meetings because they screwed up getting a place. There seems to be very little communication, a lot of infighting. They're writing bylaws to go after certain people, right? And they can't get a quorum, and it's just a mess, and there's yelling at each other. I got, you know, people are telling me Bowserman's like the voice of reason, and they're going, hey, you know, like elections are coming up. Why are we doing this? So right now, the LD17 run by Tim Cervati and a couple of those crew that are, there's some people who are trying to make it happen. Chris King, Anna Clark, Nancy Considine, right? The LD17 is a dysfunctional mess. And they'll get reelected in November. We'll see how all that goes. But the best thing the Northwest Republican Association ever did was form and do their thing. And it showed last night. They executed. They had a great amount of volunteers. I had my timer and my scribe next to me, Jen and Laurie, who I got to hang out with. They were great. Full court press, everyone doing their work, and had a great. So if you're one of those people that say, oh my God, the Republican Party is so crazy, if you hung out with us last night, you wouldn't have said that. It was a really, really good night. A variety of Republicans, right? From the hardcore conservatives to the doofbags like John Winchester were there, right? I don't know if, what Winchester is, but anyway, the wide variety of everyone. Remember, purity doesn't win general elections. That's where you're at, right? If you guys hate what Biden's doing and the Democrats and what's going on, whatever, and you're going to send some of these crackpots up to there, well, first of all, can the crackpots win? Some of the crackpots, this is more in the LD world, right? And then when it comes to this race, a lot of people who are jumping on the Juan bandwagon, they're like, I just want a win. I want to win a seat. And they think that, you know, Juan, the reason they're saying that is Juan's a, you know, very personable, great story. Oh, he's got $1 million. And he's going to get more money, right? So when you look at Brandon Martin in 2020 as one of the most important elections in the world ever, right? He got no federal money because they didn't like him. They didn't think he can win. Right? And you say, well, it was the district. Well, no, it wasn't, because it was just that seat was held by Martha McSally for 4 years. You know? So, Matt, you're going to say
did,
something.
Did any responses, good or bad, surprise you? I mean, you mentioned the one towards the end, the one where Brandon Martin was allowed to ask a candidate a question that kind of, maybe not surprised you, but it was kind of a curveball. Were there any other comments, good or bad, that kind of really struck you or made an impression upon you?
You know, they all had good moments in the way, right? Like I said, I think Kathleen was the weakest of them, but in the end, a lot of them had good, intelligent answers for what was going on. You know, it was that idea, you know, you say, oh, politics is all about a personal attacks or blah, 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 whatever. That didn't happen yesterday. You know, and we kept it quick, right? I remember we were doing, you know, two people, 90 seconds, 90 seconds. If there was a rebuttal, great. And then we moved on. We went through 20 different questions last night, and it just on those kind of questions, and they all got their different configuration, right? I thought they all did great in the. I thought they all did great, but they all had good. Most of them had good answers to the questions.
Yeah, and mostly, you know, you've been through as many of these as I have, plus one probably, but you know, in a Republican debate or any party debate, you're going to have 80% of the people in general alignment on many of the key issues. I was just wondering if anything kind of really stuck out along the way, but
it was one of those things where they all stuck to whatever was in their heart. They didn't say anything stupid. I think you, as Republicans, we were proud that the five of them did a good job.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so that's my take out of it. So, you know, when you're worried about what's going on with the regulator constipators and Wadsack and Jones and Cory Maguire, and then, of course, the Republican death spiral of the other guy's radio show, if you go hang out here and you saw 230 Republicans doing what they did last night, you'd go, oh, there's some hope in this party. So that's what I walked out with. We always talk about culture. Right, is where it all goes back to. So maybe there's some people who think this is a good thing, but this is the Gallup poll on belief in God. And we are now down to 81%, and that is the all-time low. And as this story by Hannah Bleh talks about, while that figure seems high, it's actually the lowest percentage ever reported in the survey. They've been doing this question since, well, at least 60 years. She talks about how when Gallup asked the same question in 53, 54, 65, 67, those years, 98% said they did. Overall, 17% currently say they do not believe in God. According to the survey's findings, young people and leftists are the most likely not to believe. Belief in God has fallen to the most in recent years among young adults and people on the left of the political spectrum. This is from Gallup, liberals and Democrats. This group shows a 10 or more percentage point drop comparing the 2022 figures to the numbers in 2013 through 2017. The groups with the largest declines are also groups that are currently least likely to believe in God. Liberals, young adults, Democrats, highest among belief in God, highest among political conservatives, Republicans, 94-92%. So in the end, right, is all of these issues that we've talked about over the years eventually lead back to the culture of a society. And part of that is a moral system, right? A moral belief system. And the lack of that in relation, I don't care what your faith is, right? What I've learned is that very few people who don't have a connection to something bigger than them in the spiritual world are usually kind of miserable humans. I have a friend of mine. I've known him for, I don't know, 10 years. And he has a son who literally just is like a nihilist, right? He doesn't, there's no connection to anything. He's constantly getting in trouble. And, you know, he's you know, got tears in the beers while we're having lunch one day about this whole thing. And we got talking about the kid's upbringing. He's, you know, and, you know, this guy started with, well, I didn't want to impose my views, my beliefs. He was one of those enlightened ones. Impose my beliefs on my son, kind of thing. I wanted him to figure it out, blah, blah, blah. And what happened was he has a son who literally has been arrested, gets in fights, blah, blah, blah. And I said, I just figured out the kid has no connection to anything outside of himself. Right. And, you know, I said, you know, I don't care, you know, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, be a druid, go hang out with, believe in trees and spirit, do something. Right. But this lack of belief in God and a lack of a spiritual grounding in anything. Is this really a good thing for society? I don't see how it is. I don't, you know, and also, right, when we look at these kids, right, it's like we always talk about culture is what were the parents brought up with, and then the parents who were brought up with less than they were, their parents were brought up with any sort of moral, spiritual structure, then what happens to their parents, right? And it just becomes that exponentially blowing up problem. In order to celebrate Juneteenth, I decided to take abolitionist Frederick Douglass. And my quote was from Frederick Douglass, "It's easier to build strong children than to repair broken men." And what's happened is we've abandoned the build strong children thing. As parents, there's not everyone. I'm saying there's more than the fair share of parents out there that have they've abandoned their responsibility as parents, which is, you know, kind of part of what they do. So we talk about Father's Day, right? And we talk about the importance of fathers, and a lot of broken lives and broken kids is, you know, not having those two parents. There's something physically and spiritually right about being properly raised by a male and a female. And so Father's Day, Mother's Day is huge. I love Mother's Day, and all you ladies deserve all the love that you get. I feel like Father's Day, we think about more of the fathers who got it right. Because there's a lot of fathers and mothers that don't get it right. But in the end, when you look at our society right now, and we look at the disposability of life, and we you know, if you believe we're created by a divine being, right? Because people who believe in God have their problems too. If you believe that other people were created by the same divine being as you, right? And maybe there's a bit of the divine in that person, and you really believe that, right? You treat your fellow human in a much different way. Let's start the conversation. Give us a call, 790-2040, 790-2040. Billy, number one, good morning, sir.
Good morning. These conversations are always fraught with danger if you're talking to someone that is convinced that anything that has morality / religious overtones cannot be part of a conversation because we must maintain some kind of, you know, holy, in the secular term, separation between any conversation that has religious overtones and how society should behave itself. And my objection to that has always been a fundamental one. You don't have to believe in Christianity, Judaism, or any other faith and not accept the fundamental truth in certain teachings of those religions. And I always go back to, what is it about the golden rule that has some kind of inherent flaw that society or you as an individual shouldn't organize your life around.
Right.
Treat others like you want to be treated.
Right.
This is not a religious conversation. We can make it one if you want to, and I'm happy to do that. But for you know, whatever deity you wish to swear upon at this point, or none at all, treating others as you want to be treated, that is basic humanity. I don't care what your religious dogma is or isn't. That is what we should be about. And you touched on it. You know, are we, you know, erasing morality as part of the conversation in society? Yes, because there's people in society that are convinced that anything that has to do with morality / religiosity is somehow verboten and cannot be discussed because it makes people feel kind of funny. Treating others as you want to be treated makes you feel funny? I'm sorry. What planet, what universe, what alternate dimension are you coming from?
Well, then, as if you're someone trying to live your values, right, as a Christian, a Muslim's a different world because they don't. That we'll get to that in a second. if you're trying to live your morals, right, and let's say I'm Catholic, right, they say, well, you're one of those Catholics, right, and they're just a bunch of pro-life nutballs, and you're trying to repress me like you do nuns, and you have Catholic priests that did bad things, right, and they throw everything out about what Catholicism believes because of a few bad actors, right? Right?
Mm-hmm.
But of course, you ever want to talk about Muslim and about, you know, actors that kill people, then you say, well, you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater, right? Because it's kind of like what they think they want to get out of you or don't want to get out of you, right? And you're right. Again, it's the idea that all these things that we talk about, there's so many universal truths out there that come from the great faith traditions of the world, that, like you said, the golden rule, right? The Ten Commandments, right? Kind of like there's some wisdom of the desert fathers and mothers in there, right?
Mm-hmm.
Thou shalt not kill, it's a great place to start, right? You shouldn't lie. You shouldn't covet your thing. Look about covet, right? Look how big that is, right? The keeping up with the Joneses is one of the sickest dynamics of American society. We have President of American Tax Reform, Americans for Tax Reform, Grover Norquist. Grover, welcome back, sir.
Good to be with you. Hello, Toussaint.
Hey, I was just watching Corinne Pierre there, our amazing press secretary. Hold on, I got it. Keep my straight face.
And when he says amazing,
and she says that the Biden administration has everyone's prepared for a good and stable economy, or whatever she said yesterday. I mean, how does this stuff fall out of their mouths? It's amazing.
Well, okay, maybe she's telling the truth. They are prepared for a stable economy. The problem is that's not what they're going to get. It's like when you walk out into a thunderstorm being prepared for a sunny day. Sometimes people tell the truth when they don't realize it. They think they're lying, but they've actually said something that's true. They are prepared. They'd be in great shape if the economy was stable and doing well. It isn't. And look, here's the challenge Biden has. He says, I get mad at myself when I do something that screws things. I know it's my fault, and I did it, and just no fun at all. I can deal with problems if, you know, some guy runs into me with a car. Well, that wasn't my fault. But if I run into something, you know, Biden's presidency is nothing but self-inflicted wounds, friendly fire from himself, where he inflated the currency. He took $2 trillion we don't have and threw it up in the air and said, don't go to work. We're going to be writing checks to people. And then surprised when the economy, we didn't add any jobs to the economy in the first year when we threatened to spend the $2 trillion that the economists, the government economists, hadn't expected to come in just from the recovery and lightening up on COVID restrictions and so on. No, nobody went to work because of $2 trillion. Now, people walked away with money. 20% of it went to people in China, Russia, scam artists. Hopefully, we had some domestic scam artists stealing that money, not just foreigners, but it seems like the Russians. And I don't know why it is, but the Nigerians are very big in this business. I talked to one of the guys who designs efforts to stop people from stealing money from unemployment insurance and other things that the Biden people were throwing money at. And I said, well, why is it Nigeria? What's the matter with Ghana or whatever? He said, no, Ghana does it too. It's not as much as Nigeria in terms of getting people to come in and hack into government programs. So 20% went to somebody that wasn't supposed to have it. Some of them aren't even Americans. This is all what Biden did. Then he shuts down the pipelines. He says he's going to shut down all energy. And then he wonders why there isn't more investment in energy and why people don't look for more energy. Having said, he does what he did in Kabul, convincing the world that he's Jimmy Carter weak. So just one thing after another, and it's all his fault. And how does he wake up in the morning and come up with a new theory about why it's Putin's fault greedy businessmen. Inflation's caused by a greedy businessman. Evidently, when Trump was president, businessmen in America did not want to make more money. But as soon as Biden got elected, they all wanted to make more money. That was what happened.
It reminds me of that movie 50 First Dates, where the guy has the short-term memory problem, so he can't remember what happened the day before. And that's why he said 50 First Dates kind of thing. I feel like that's Biden. He doesn't even know what's going on half the time.
But what it does do is it just makes it obvious what the modern Democrat Party is. It's around the table, and Biden gets to sit at the head of the table. That's you win the presidency, you get to fly on the plane, you get to sit at the head of the table. But around the table, everything you do has to be checked with the teachers' union, the public sector unions, the big city political machines like Chicago and so on. They need cash to keep operating. You have the two wings of the dependency movement, people who are locked into welfare dependency, and people who make $120,000 a year managing the dependency of other people, making sure none of them get jobs and become Republicans. And then you've got all the coercive utopians, Bloomberg's world. You know, I'm smarter and better than you. Let me run your life. You don't want a big gulp. You don't want a vape. You want a teeny car that you can get killed in when you run into a bridge abutment, not a big car that's safe. And by the way, let me show you your new light bulbs, what they're going to look like, and the new 2-hour effort to wash your clothes and dry your clothes, and the dishwashers that take forever, because we'll tell you later why it's important. It used to be important to have hot, small, teeny, lightweight cars that are dangerous because they're not made of metal, they're made of plastic, because we were running out of oil. Then we weren't running out of oil. Now you have to have the same rules because global warming. First global cooling, then global warming, now global change. Somehow they seem to always have the same set of rules that they want to put in. And the reason can change from time to time, but what they want to make us do doesn't change.
So, of course, what's beautiful here, and by beautiful I mean terrifying, is we decided we're going to basically, you know, we've only been reliant on oil and gas for, I don't know, a century or so. And now we're going to basically shut down all production. We're going to, you know, we got what's going on with Ukraine and the Russian natural gas, but we have no plan to replace it other than people who have no money should buy a $70,000 car. Is the mainstream America picking up on that yet, or is it just me and you?
I don't know, because it's never discussed in the press. Quote unquote, wind and solar and so on, it's about 3% of energy in the world. It's just a fraction of a fraction. It's not something that can get more efficient or more effective, because there's just limits to how much you can change one thing into the other. And then you've got to put it in a battery, which loses some more of the energy. If you want it to work at night, or when it's not windy, these are not things that generate power all the time when you turn on a switch. There was an article in The Guardian about, people have got to get rid of this idea that there's just going to be energy whenever you need it. We're going to organize our life around when the energy is ready. You will wash your dishes when the sun shines, and you will be able to cook your food when the wind blows, but not in between. A friend who used to be our chief of staff here went to Kenya for 20 years to go work there, and they only get power certain times of the day, and you just organize around it. It can be done. I don't think we should do this to American people, but and Kenya doesn't want to do this because they like it. They just can't afford more better. They would first. I'd really like the 24-hour energy. That would be good. Is that an option here in Kenya? Well, not everywhere in Kenya. So, and coming to a city near you, they're talking about brownouts now here. If energy gets more expensive, we're expected to use less of it. They want us to ride on subways, not on highways. I mean, I don't quite understand what in the psyche of the liberals, why they like this, but it does happen to give you control over people. In Russia, you know where everybody is because they ride on trains, not on highways.
We got our good friend Dan Shearer, Green Valley News. How's your brother doing? It looks like he's back again.
He is. He's been back in Ukraine for about 3 weeks. He is edging close to where the action is, and it's a pretty dangerous week, actually. The Russians have decided that anybody who is helping people get to the western part of the country is actually kidnapping them. And so, because, of course, they now consider it their territory and those people Russian citizens, and so it's made things a little dicier, but he has managed to get a lot of supplies to people, particularly orphanages, et cetera, and is working hard. We had a group of women here make some quilts, and those actually arrived yesterday, and he's taking those literally to the front. Lots of people in that area who could I guess be reminded that people here have not forgotten about them and the struggle. So it continues, and he's in the thick of it.
Tell me about what's the reality of the struggle? What do the Ukrainians feel? Do they feel like they're winning? Are we just in stalemate time? What's the reality of what your brother's, what is he hearing from people on the ground?
What he's hearing from people on the ground is that their number one fear is that people are going to forget about them. And the struggle is as real today as it was on day one. Someone is trying to take their land, and they are not going to allow that to happen. There definitely was a turn in the 3 weeks my brother was home, and that is that the Russians kind of developed a different strategy, focused on the east, and have had some big wins. This shouldn't be a surprise given the strength of their military, although they're incredibly inept, but the strength of their military and, again, carting in mercenaries from other parts of the world. So we're not surprised at this, but I think there are some real basic things that they're concerned about. Running out of ammunition is one of them. Troops that are being fatigued or, frankly, being killed off. And not having the proper training. So this is why you see Zelensky on TV a lot begging for some basics. Is you know what, if they have to fight it themselves, they will do it. And the United States has given an awful lot of money toward this. We know this. And they're grateful for it, but the struggle is not over. And so it's very interesting to see Putin at an economic conference recently talk about how you know, things are pretty fairly stable in his country, that the economic sanctions and businesses pulling out and all this hasn't had a real impact, which is absolutely a lie. And Russian leadership has lied for forever. And so it has had a huge impact, but they are still trying to send that message to their people that it's not a big deal, and we will be stronger without them. So, but we also see that they threaten other countries. I think Lithuania may have been just the latest ones when they're making decisions that could harm the Russians. So Russia is certainly not on its knees, but it has not been in a battle. It's expected to be a very short battle, and it hasn't been. So I can't say that they're encouraged, but I can say they're driven, and that's how we would be if somebody tried to come in and take our country.
Hey, let's switch gears on you again. Did you watch the part of the board meeting yesterday where Cazares Kelly decided not to show up to answer questions?
We had a reporter there. I didn't actually watch it, but we have a story, and I'm well aware of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. So Steve Christie's like, well, here's all the questions I was going to ask her. And what's really interesting when you watch the video is Bronson, who, of course, criticizing Cazares Kelly's inexperience, got excused by a racist by her own party.
Correct.
She's in for what with Steve. She's like, what? Why would you do that? What? Right? I mean, it's she was pretty openly derisive of Cazares Kelly's ineptitude and, oh, her own derisiveness.
Well, exactly. And, you know, there's a couple of questions we should ask on this. And, again, she sent out voter ID cards. Under any scenario, should you send something to voters that is incorrect? And that's what she did. And then, and the bigger question is, why the hurry? She was not under any statutorily imposed deadlines to do this. Wait, we have redrawn districts. We do this every 10 years. The Board of Supervisors approved the changes, and there would have been plenty of time to get the cards to voters in whatever arbitrary deadline that she set. And there was just no need to do it. So it's going to cost us a little more than $20,000 to resend 84,000 cards. And This I know is chump change to the county, but it's $20,000 to me, and I'm a taxpayer. And so don't write that off as just being, oh, yeah, we can, that's contingency money. And I think that rubbed Sharon Bronson the wrong way also. It's like, no, it's taxpayer money, and we have to spend every single penny like it's our own. And I think that's what's not going on here. And very briefly, people are going to say, well, gosh, why didn't Steve get really upset that she wasn't there? Doesn't she answer to him? She doesn't. She's elected. She answers to voters.
Well, he also controls one-fifth of her budget.
That's right. That's that's what he does have.
All right.
By the way.
All right, my friend. Great job as always. Have a good week.
Thank you.
The National Bureau of Economic Research decided to do a study on the American Rescue Plan. Talking about...
Would this be an independent analysis?
Yes. So it talked about this is the multi-trillion-dollar economic stimulus package meant to jumpstart the economy, create and save jobs, combat inflation, they said originally.
Yeah, there, that one didn't age too well, did it?
Let me go back to the swordsman and Princess Bride. You keep using the word, but you don't seem to know what it means. Bob's back again. So anyway, how much did it cost for every... It says for every year of employment it saved, how much did it cost the American taxpayer? Right? So basically for a job, basically, right? The average job in America, you know, what does that pay? Probably $40,000, $50,000 a year, right? So what did... So to save that one job... That pays that, Matt. How much do you think it costs the federal government through this horse crap?
So is that a fraction or a multiple? Just to give me a little gauge.
It's a great question. Hold on. He gets a great question thing for that. It's a multiple.
2x. So 100,000.
I understand 2x.
Not for you.
Higher.
250,000.
Higher.
So we're at 50,000 is like we're saying is the average job.
Yep.
And let's say 8x. So let's say 400.
855,000.
Get out. Get out.
So we spent $855,000 to save 1 year of a job. Average job in America. Wow, it's inflation's transitory.
And we wonder why prices are going through the roof.
And again, so one of the listeners, when Joanne was talking about all that $30 million of CARES money and Fed money they were throwing around like drunk sailors at the counties, and he said, well, multiply that by all the other municipalities, right? And then I see an article this morning that there's a bunch of money that hasn't even hit yet. That's the other part that's scary about the inflation thing, right? Is you're literally here. This is, this was on... Maria Mornings with Maria. Oh, Bill Hagerty, Republican from Tennessee, said I spoke with a ranking member and said the several states received hundreds of billions of dollars in money, and he says the money hasn't even been appropriated yet. Wait till that hits the economy.
Just the theater of the absurd here.
You know, I want to speak some French.
Oui.
So thank you very much. Nailed it. Nailed it. You know, the other thing that we keep talking about, and it was another piece in CNN. This is by Henry Enten. And basically, he talks about, you know, we've had this discussion about how Hispanics, the Juan Ciscomani mentioned in the debate on Monday that the Hispanic approval rating for Biden is at like 26% right now. We know a group, and we all talk about how Republicans need to embrace, again, that the values of the Republican Party really match up better with Hispanics. We just do a crappy job making the case and connecting, right? Pro-life, pro-family, very supportive of the freedom of religion, you know, pro-small business, right? Such an entrepreneurial, hardworking group of humanity. But this is another one this guy, Henry Enten, who works for CNN, okay? Is Democrats are losing ground with the fastest growing political bloc. And you know what that is? That's Asian Americans. We had that one guy on last year. I forgot what his name was, but it was about how the Democrat Party really can't stand Asians. And he was Asian. Okay. And he's talking about the recall of Chesa Conover in San Francisco, the district attorney there. I said it again. Chesa Boudin. Boudin. The recalled. I keep saying Conover. Chris.
Just the innocent slip of the tongue.
Chris, come on. Anyway, it talked about how national polling, right? The Pew Research Center shows that Biden's standing with Asians has dropped. He started with a 53% approval rating and 47%. And now he said he won Asian voters by 44. He won Asian voters by 44 points in 2020. But it sounds like Pew's gave the Democrats had a 28% advantage among Asians on a ballot test. But then as they keep going down, it keeps dropping by 16% by what Biden won in 2020. And they talk about, well, you know, we saw the Asian American vote really come out hard is the mama bears, right? In Virginia, and talking about these schools that education is very sacred and very important to Asian families, right? It is something that is very high on their priority list. And when they saw all the craziness going on in these schools, those Asian American mama bears, they were out there saying, we're not putting up with this crap. So anyway, Republicans, we'll talk about this with Shelley Keis tomorrow. She'll be on in the third hour. We'll talk about what we feel like the Republican Party's doing in relation to these demographics that are running away from the Democrat Party. So it's very cute. I have a friends of the show who are brother-sister, and they both sent me the same kind of update within about five. I didn't tell them this yet. They know if they're listening to it now. They both sent me like five minutes apart from each other. The wild and wacky day in Tucson. So let me introduce you to Rahina, the Tucson of Rahina Romero, Steve Kaplopchik, Jeff Dahl, the Avis Hunter, right? Lane Santa Cruz, a wonderful, wonderful young lady. The invisible, you know, the
doctor.
Is
she not a doctor?
Like who, Santa Cruz?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh, please. I hope. I pray to Jesus she's a doctor. That would be amazing. So just like Dr. Jill Biden, Dr. Lane Santa Cruz, right, who said, I remember when she was running for office, someone sent me her on a podcast. This is classic Lane Santa Cruz. Sending your kid to public school is an act of colonialism. Just want to tell you that. I don't know what that means, but I'm sure D.A. Morales will write Patty about it. Now, and then you got the Invisible Woman, Nikki Lee. That's what she is. She's her, like Kevin Dahl is almost the Invisible Man because there's nothing much there coming out of him that's worth a while. And then Nikki Lee, who's
Kevin or Jeff? I'm confused.
Oh, that's right. Jeff Dahl. Sorry. I forgot on his, that thing I heard on the radio. I heard a commercial or something with his name on it. That had Jeff on it. I think it was on The Truth. I think it was right after, I think it was after James T's show that I heard that. So, people are like, what year is this? I asked that myself. So anyway, the, I got my warnings about what was going on with Tucson yesterday afternoon. And you're like, well, there was a little monsoon action going, and monsoon hit Catalina really bad. Bev was emailed me that I had some friends that were eating at It's Greek to me last night, and the power went out. And then Bev emailed me overnight to say that 10 poles went down because of a microburst in Catalina. So we got that going for us. So anyway, let's start off. Let's get with the light stuff first. Okay, this is what was going on in Tucson yesterday afternoon. Okay, this is just the aperitif to the main dish of misery. So, now, as a friend of mine lovingly calls it, B-dubs, okay, the Buffalo Wild Wings on Irvington. Now, I assume this is the one clearly closer to the Spectrum.
Near I-19, yeah. Mm-hmm.
They had, in the parking lot, maybe this was a fight between bone-in and boneless wings.
Could have been, right?
There's no such thing as a boneless wing.
Or the flats versus the drumettes.
Right.
Could have been. I mean, because them's fighting words.
You are correct. But we had
mild versus honey mustard or whatever.
Or they were trying to recreate the knife fight in the Beat It video.
Could have been.
Right?
It could have been art. Yeah.
If it was the Eat It video, they'd be holding a chicken together. Now, a couple of people armed with knives were fighting each other in the Buffalo Wild Wings parking lot.
Oh, goodness.
All right. So that's the first one. Okay. Now, the second one. Now, this is on Belvedere, north of Speedway. Now, Belvedere feels very centralist, right? That's like Swanish. Right in that area, Speedway, Swan.
I'm trying to, isn't it?
Or maybe closer. Actually, I think Belvedere is closer to
Wilmot, maybe.
Yeah, I think that's right. Right? So we got that
for
going.
Some reason,
for us.
I think it's by Trader Joe's. It sounds.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
All right. So over on Belvedere, we had four males armed with baseball bats assaulting another male in the wash. Okay, so we had that going for us, right? Then I already told you KGUN9 already said the night before about Travis Peters Delta. They finally covered the story about a guy trying to light his place on fire, $3,000 worth of damages. Okay, so we got that going for us, but then we have this other story where A guy flees a traffic stop over near Congress and I-10. This started at 1:30. The man fired shots at the officer, then drove off. Suspect drove a gray truck. He crashed into a vehicle on a side street. Sounds this is right by the Mercado. On Avenida del Convento. Again, it sounds like a bad Western, you know, the Hopalong Cassidy at the shootout at Del Mercado. Okay. According to TPD Sergeant Richard Gradias. Now, the part that's interesting about this is Pima Community College police did the stop.
Made the traffic stop. Correct. Okay. The news story said.
Now, then it says, Gradia says, TPD was contacted. We responded, set up a small unit tactics with basically we blocked off the area. Units from our tac squad, which is comprised of SWAT, arrived on the scene. During the search of the area, they located the adult male suspect with obvious, basically it sounds like this man shot himself at that
right.
point.
Self-inflicted was what the article
okay.
said.
Now, again, you got the raw story. This is Craig Smith on KGUN. You got the raw story of what's going on. So here's the question for you. This is just, I know very few people know this word. I want to do the lasers, right? Kind of like Dr. Evil. Follow up, right? The follow-up question here is, I'm not saying that, now, of course, Pima Community College, is their police can do that kind of thing, right? It's not like they're, you know, it's not like they're in the Vatican and they can only stay on the grounds of a PCC thing. And I'm glad they're out there, okay? The question is, why did Pima Community College police do a stop on I-10 and Congress? So that's the question.
What was the reason for the traffic stop,
right,
in the first?
So now, don't get me wrong, if he was over on Greasewood area, right, and he was, you know, like the guy sitting there and this guy zips by at 110 miles an hour, and then by the time he slowed him down, it was there, I got it. Something like that. But if you're telling, what I want to know, did PCC get a call about this? Sorry, did TPD get a call, right? Did it go into the 911 operator? Here's this is where follow-ups count, kids, right? Did, come back to me now.
Did a 911 call go into
TPD? And TPD couldn't cover it. That's the question.
Good question.
Right? That's the question. So, Craig, when you got Gradia sitting there in his shirt and tie giving you answers, and Craig's been around for 90 years, so maybe he did ask it, and maybe it'll come on a future story. I pray. Okay. Did the call go into 911, and when the 911 was looking for a TPD officer, there weren't enough to send? That's what we need to know. That's way important. So then while all this is going on, right, in the city that never sleeps, right, we got, think about this, all in an afternoon, I got guys beating up, four guys with bats beating up a dude in a wash. I got guys having knife fights in the parking lot of the Buffalo Wild Wings at Tucson Spectrum, which of course is a place where the city collects sales tax to pay for bills.
That.
Right? Then I have a guy doing a shootout with cops at the Mercado. Right? That's in Menlo Park, I believe, area. And then this comes out of the mayor.
Hello, colleagues and friends. I'm Tucson Mayor Regina Romero, joining you virtually from the ancestral lands of the Tohono O'odham and Pascua-Yaqui peoples. I am so sorry I couldn't be with you in person in D.C., but I am glad to share some of the work we are doing here in Tucson. As one of the fastest warming cities in the nation, Tucson is taking a nature-based approach to address extreme heat. Through the Tucson Million Trees program, we are planting 1 million trees by 2030, investing in heat vulnerable and low-income neighborhoods. These million trees are part of the 1T.org U.S. pledge. Tucsonans are holding hands with cities, organizations, and businesses across the country to advance the equitable distribution of trees.
Look at those eyeballs moving while she's trying to read it.
Tucson has planted or distributed over 45,000 trees in the past 2 years, and we are using the American Forest Tree Equity Score Map to chart our efforts.
Tree equity!
The private sector is a critical partner in this effort, helping me fundraise over $500,000 to significantly increase tree plantings this year. The partnerships and best practices through the 1T.org's U.S. Stakeholder Council are helping us make important progress.
I'm sorry you have to puke your cream of wheat up on your table.
I am proud to include Tucson as part of this national effort to conserve, restore, and grow trees and forests, and I encourage other
cities
to join
the movement. We're growing trees and forests! She just said forests!
Hello, colleagues.
Oh,
and
please
friends.
Stop.
I'm Tucson Mayor Rahim.
Oh, my God. That's like torture. Woof.
Do it again.
You know that the water torture one where they drip that thing on your head, the little water? Right? You know, the city already has a torture device, which is making people read the Steve K newsletters. And now you got this lady on a loop. All right, let's go to break. 6:18 in the morning. You're on Wake Up Tucson. And I kind of wonder what I want to say to you, too, when we come back, is there's something different going on in the world of Tucson, right? And you're dealing with two guys here who have been looking at the news distribution for years. And this is Matt and I will come back and tell you why this is different, what we're seeing in the last 2 to 3 years, because this blank just got real and realer. Wake up. We've talked about all the reasons why we're here for the price of gas and inflation. We've covered that a lot. We know that even the Chairman Powell said that the idea that everything's Russia's fault isn't actually true, as we all knew, other than the president and his cabal. But now they want to do a tax holiday. What do you think about the gas tax holiday, Dave?
Let's see. What would be the best way I can describe it? Oh, yeah. Asinine. It's absolutely absurd. and look, we all want a lower price, but it doesn't do it. Maryland, actually, we have some fascinating data that Maryland did a version of this. And so for about 2 weeks, the price came down, and then, boom, it went back up because more people were driving. Whether we like it or not, the way markets work is there's this concept of demand destruction. How many times have you heard the term, the solution to high prices? It's high prices. You know, because when prices go up, it brings in more investment. And the more investment creates more supply, and more supply brings the price down. If you want to crash the price of health care, it turns out what the Biden administration and Democrats have done is they've screwed up that rule of that economic rule that high prices brings in more investment, except they've made the more investment virtually illegal.
Right.
You know, when you have to file new documents with the Securities and Exchange Commission, when you're going to be scored on did you, you know, invest in things that produce hydrocarbons, you know, the regulatory, the threats to your banking credit lines. So we have high prices. There should be a wave, a tsunami of cash, of investment going into extracting natural gas and hydrocarbons and refining capacity and pipelines. And none of that can happen under all the bureaucracy and administrative rules, you know, the green agenda. And that's the real problem.
So, a question. So when you see the delirious man who says he's the president and various Democrats talking about record profits from oil companies and they're just taking advantage of this and they're all evil, which they may be mildly evil, but what do you say to that?
It's almost like they decided to step back to the late 1970s, grab Jimmy Carter's playbook, and repeat. And you just look at them going, this is absurd. But they would start a war within the left if they told the truth. You know, the truth is very simple. After the 2018 election, when Democrats took control of Congress, they began an agenda of trying to make it much more risky to invest in anything it had to do with oil, gas, you know, refining, you know, extraction, movement of the products. And so it's intellectually lazy to say, well, it was the cancellation of a pipeline. It was a bit. Or it's the lease permits that are available are on areas that don't have hydrocarbons. Okay, that's partially true. The biggest problem is when we had the huge demand destruction during 2020, during the pandemic, lots of oil fields, lots of the infrastructure shut down. Because remember, oil prices went negative for a while because we didn't have enough storage capacity.
Right.
Now that prices have come back, there should be a wave of money moving back into those areas to reopen those fields. But now you can't get the loan or you can't get the money. So to go and blame oil companies or refiners, well, okay, how many permits is this administration willing to give for new refineries?
Zero.
So you're going to attack big oil's profits. At the same time, you're the one creating scarcity through your restrictions on capital and your regulatory. It's just like no one showed up to their elementary school economics class. But they know what they're doing. This is purposeful. This is quite purposeful.
Again, anyway, David, thank you for what you do. I appreciate it. Thanks for the call in. We're running out of time, and have a great weekend, and we'll talk soon, man.
You're very kind. Goodbye, all.
Later, my friend. You're at the 27th annual Wake Up Tucson Pizza Summit. We've brought everyone in to have this hardcore discussion. First and foremost, friend of the show, valuable sponsor, Rocco. What's up,
morning,
my friend? Rocco's little Chicago.
I'd like to open this pizza summit today.
I pledge allegiance to the
flag. To the pie.
Instead of a gavel, I have a calzone, and I just slap that on the old
right.
on the old counter. You heard the girlish laughter of Mr. Matt Russell.
Good morning.
Good morning, amigo. How are you?
How am I? Look at what I'm surrounded by, man. I got Daddy O. McCluskey over here. I got King Rocco here. I'm in heaven.
And you got a thing of pizza and wings that's on a plate from Rocco's.
It doesn't get any better than this, brother.
Sean McCluskey.
How we doing?
Welcome back.
Hi, Sean.
Thank you.
Congratulations on baby Mac to you and Ash.
Huge.
Yeah.
Huge.
Six pounds, 2 ounces, 18.75 inches long.
What? Adorable.
Ouch.
Yeah. Mama's doing well?
She's doing great.
Yay.
She's freaking awesome.
She's a hero.
Yeah. No, I mean, number one, that whole thing, what an experience. Wow.
We should just dedicate the rest of the show to her.
There we go.
I mean, come on. Yeah,
works for me. It. Her or Peyton. Take them both because Peyton's right. been a trooper. I mean, you want to talk about, like, I don't even have to go near the kid. I want to, but I can't get in there because Peyton's hovering. It's awesome.
Right.
Yeah, she's all over him.
Her
big sister.
Peyton's the big sister for newbies out there.
Big sister's all over baby brother.
Very cool. Well, congratulations.
Thanks. A lot of fun.
And I'm glad you got to experience the birth of your child. That's an amazing thing.
It truly is. Yep. It's like, if you have never done it, I suggest you do it, but we'll do it with the right person. Just don't do it to do it because it is an experience.
This is a pizza summit, but I have a baby question. Who was in the room when she delivered?
Me and three doctors.
Okay, good. Excellent. This thing about when they have the entire family in there.
Oh, no. Let me explain something real quick. COVID is alive and real.
Oh, so this is a good part of COVID?
No, this is a horrible part. Peyton was PO'd like you wouldn't believe because Peyton's under 18, so she wasn't allowed into the postpartum room after because she was under 18.
Okay.
And then you can only have one guest, and you have one... I don't know what they called me, but I was the stanchion. I could be there whenever I wanted to be, but then there could only be one guest in the room. And if I left, they couldn't bring anybody else. It was just, oh my God.
I just know friends that when this poor woman's giving birth and going through all this, it's like a small family reunion going inside the room. You know what I mean?
It's like a pep team.
Is this lemon delivery or is this a quinceanera for crying out loud?
There's a couple of ways to look at that. When you're in your bedroom, who do you want else in there with you? And if they're not in there with you when you had the experience, they're not in there on the delivery. How's that?
That sounds fine with me.
All right.
Having done this twice.
Okay, see, all right, so Rocco's on board.
Nancy, if you're listening, we need three doctors tonight.
Again, welcome to the 27th annual Pizza Summit. It all started with, you know, Rocco was scheduled to come on today anyway. Tomorrow's the big pizza throwdown.
Yes.
Is there tickets available for the pizza throwdown?
Sold out as of 10 a.m. either yesterday or the day before. I forgot which
one. Look at that.
150 tickets.
That's awesome.
Boom.
You're back, like Frank Costanza. I'm back,
right,
baby.
Right, yeah. I think this is like the fifth annual with a couple of years skipped.
Sure.
That's how it goes. Yeah.
And remember, we're having the Road Ain't Done happy hour at Rocco's on July 12th, 5:30.
Right.
And
it was going to be the Road Is Done cocktail hour. I think that was the original. Yeah. Anyway, that's what's up.
Now, you nailed it, though. I said, let's get a ribbon and only cut it halfway.
Yeah.
And you said, yours is a better idea. We get the candles that that reignite after you blow them out.
Right.
Because that is your experience.
Serve undercooked wings.
Ooh. Ew. The city drops off six dozen undercooked gummy wings. Right. Congratulations.
Gave me the shivers.
So, in relation to what we want to get done in the pizza summit today, right? We
want to talk. There's an agenda.
Heck yes.
Yeah, let's see.
Very much.
What do you got?
Why is your mic? Why do you sound low on your mic?
I don't know.
There you go. You got to bring it up a little bit. Yeah, there you go. Better for your posture too.
I'm gonna get more intimate.
Thank you.
This mic.
There's the Rocco. There's the Rocco NPR voice.
Yeah, there it is.
Let's go to Rocco DeGrazia with a report in Tucson, Arizona.
That's lovely. Thank you for inviting me.
So my thing is, we talked about whenever we do this on Facebook, what's your favorite two places, right? It blows up, right? Everyone's got their favorite pizza place. It's an ubiquitous food item out there, right? We all have our different ways. So I want to talk about our favorite places. I want to talk about, before this is over, how we like to cook it, because a lot of us are cooking it at home also.
Sure.
You know what I mean? And I think it's the idea. I don't know if I want to have the pineapple debate today. That'll be kind of an addendum item before it's all over. But for you guys, we'll start with Rocco and move around the table. What is what's the definition of a perfectly cooked pizza in your mind? Because everyone's all in the eye of the beholder.
Sure.
What's perfectly?
It depends on the style, but always it has to have some toast on the cheese and a browned crust, you know, bordering on slightly darker than brown.
Gotcha. So,
yeah. And if it doesn't have that, then you haven't caramelized your sugars and toasted the cheese, and those are two things that make the pizza taste good.
It's supposed to look like this.
Yeah, see, dude.
This is right
there. There it is.
Yeah. Yeah, but you're all here, so we can talk about the brown, crusty cheese.
Sure.
Wait, and, swipe to the right. That's from Labor and Delivery.
No,
there it is. Yeah.
And then for Neapolitan pizza, it has to be black somewhere on the pizza. There has to be a char. And if you didn't do that, then you spent a lot of money on the oven.
I bought an oven that can go to 800 degrees, but yeah. We undercooked a pizza.
Exactly.
How about you, Matt?
Well, so I'm a thin pizza guy, and so when I go to Rocco's, you know, I do sort of that, like the Midwestern thin, right?
Sure.
And so you know you're from Chicago when someone waltzes into Rocco's and orders that Midwestern pie with some sausage. I mean,
yeah,
I love that style. I love the crisp. I love the crunch. I love the crack. And I couldn't agree with you more, Rocco, about the char. You know, I've actually been in pizzerias where I have observed guests register a complaint because the pizza was burned. Now there,
and
so
it wasn't,
and it was
not even close.
Not even close. So the respect for the pie is to render that char. First thing I do when I, particularly when I go to a pizzeria that I've never been to, is I pick up the slice and I look at the outer edge of the crust and I look underneath. I raise it, put the hood up a little bit.
This is Pizza Summit info that
love that. And not only do I want to see char, I want to be able to see the way the char actually renders onto my fingertips. You know, you get a little bit of that char, that little bit of that dust. So, but you know you have nailed that perfect pie when, and I can't talk about caramelizing and yeasting and proofing and all that. That's your lane. But when I think about the perfect pie texturally, I want to hear that crust. I want to hear that crack. I want to see the crusts kind of break apart. But inside that interior of the crust, I want to have that sort of a little bit more pillowy.
Chew.
So
chewy.
Exactly. That's the better word. So crust and crack and crunch on the out on the exterior, but a nice chew. And I don't have, I mean, I've tried to make pizzas a few times. I don't know from a science perspective how that happens. I mean, I'm going to leave that to the trained professionals here on the console. But that's kind of when I think about the perfect pie, that experience is what I'm after.
To me, on the crust too, right? If you're especially on a thin crust Neapolitan, not a party cut, right?
Sure.
And I got a triangle here. You know, I want to fold it,
yeah.
Right? And I want that thing to hold shape.
Here comes the New York Goomba. So I was going to say you have two schools of thought here. You have New York pie, and you have Chicago pie, and they're completely different, but yet they're exactly the same.
Explain, Lucy.
Well, your New York pie is cut in you get a pie anywhere in New York, the five boroughs, you've got five different types of pizza. And if you get a New York slice, it's a triangle pepperoni slice. It slaps you in the elbow, and the grease runs
what
down.
What do you mean slapping
places.
You in the elbow? What is that?
When you
mean?
Do your fold, it doesn't hold.
Right.
That would be like a Brooklyn-style pizza. I've had pizza in Brooklyn that it folded and hit me in the elbow, and I was like, this is horrible. And then I go...
Well, that's bad New York
pizza. Yeah, I agree.
Okay.
But at 3 a.m., it's always good. And then if you go to other places in New York, you get what you're talking about. You can fold it, and it's got the nice bottom, the nice doneness on the bottom. It's almost a little slight brown, good little tan texture.
Right.
And how do you get the chew? You get the chew because you just don't make your dough and then serve it right away. You got to let it rest for a little bit. The longer it sits there, the more active that yeast gets, the better your chew is.
And when we hear about proofing, is that what's happening? Is when you let that dough kind of sit and rest and relax? Is that where it's proofing?
Yeah, well, yeah, proofing isn't really the right word. It's rising.
Right. Yes.
Proofing is when you like, you know, throw some yeast and some sugary water and see if it works or not. But that's generally, but that's what they're talking about is proofing the dough means puffing it up. And yeah, if you let it sit overnight, what you're doing is you're letting it rest and the enzymes in the yeast will actually break down some of the proteins and denature them. So it won't, like if you make pizza right after you make the dough, it's going to have really big bubbles in it and kind of a crappy texture. But the next day, the bubbles are going to be a lot smaller because the gluten's been broken down a little bit by the enzymes and stuff. And it just gives it a way better texture, too, and it gives it more yeasty flavor. And that's what you're talking about.
Yep. And of course,
beautiful.
I can give you a pizza dough recipe at any given time. My mom and dad, I was raised in a pizza place. They owned five of them in Chicago, and we broke the recipe down, and I've been making this dough from memory since I was 13 years old.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, daughter and I make it all the time.
Do you use the Chicago water?
No. I wish I could, but I don't transport it in. And it makes a huge difference because, see, in Chicago, the recipe calls for 1 cup and 1 teaspoon of water. And down here, I got to use 1 1/4 cups of water.
Now, is that recharged water then from the Colorado River? Or
Well, it's coming straight out the tap here or out my filter on the fridge. But
All right. Let's do it.
One of the weird things about making dough in Tucson, especially if you have a swamp-cooled kitchen, is the hydration of the flour is a lot different depending on the season. You know, in the bone-dry pre-summer, when we don't even have the coolers on and stuff, the flour dries out a lot. So you have to add maybe just a little bit more water.
Who knew?
And now, you know, you have to add less because the flour has sucked up a bunch of humidity by sitting in my kitchen overnight and stuff like that. Yeah, seriously, man.
No, it makes sense.
It's a living thing. You gotta roll with the dough as it is.
Hey, I got a quick question for Rocco from a listener, and then we'll go to break. He was asking about Chicago pizza, right? But he talked about cornmeal crust.
Sure.
There's two things
he could be talking about. There's actually cornmeal in some Chicago
pizza. That's what he's looking for.
Yeah, I don't think anybody in town does that. That would be like a Geno's style crust and stuff, and there actually is some cornmeal. So it's a crumbly crust. It's not a lot of cornmeal, but it's enough to give it. It's almost like making pizza with like semolina or something.
Correct. Because I've made pizza dough with semolina flour.
It's the same kind of thing. Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay.
And it's crunchy when the edges like get pointy. They get real crunchy with the cornmeal. Yeah. Also, like they could be talking about if for thin crust. A lot of places with deck ovens will use cornmeal to lubricate the bottom, and that like burns and has a specific smell and bitter,
I like that too.
Bitter flavor. I wish I could do that. That's the one thing right. I can't do in my conveyor oven that I wish I could do.
Another thing, what kind of flour do you use when you make your pizza dough?
I use what's called bouncer flour, and it's a high gluten flour. A lot of people use lower gluten flour, especially for Chicago thin crust, but I think this just works for me.
So. Okay. What about you? You're using AP?
I use King Arthur's.
A King Arthur what?
All-purpose, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, or the bread flour. I like the bread flour, too. Yeah. But I use both of them. And it's an expensive flour. It's like $6 a pound or a bag. I mean, it's not
there was
cheap.
There was a weird sale around the holidays
told me about this. I bought out the store.
I got more King Arthur in my house right now. I look like a cocaine dealer. That's how much nice. White powder is in my house. 7:19 in the morning. You're on the Wake Up Tucson show. The first opening meeting of the 27th annual Wake Up Tucson Pizza Summit has concluded. We're going to move into the second part. On the bottom hour, we have...
I'm pleased to be at the Pizza Summit today.
Susan from the Gluten Free Girls is going to talk about gluten free pizza for a lot of you people that are suffering from such things that you need to eat gluten free. And then we got Matt Cable and one of the younger Espina kids coming at 7:45.